Welcome, everyone, to this week's strength seminar. We're excited to have Henry Maxfield here today, virtually, and he'll be telling us about black hole information, space-time wormholes, and baby universes. So take it away.
Yeah, thanks for the introduction. It's nice to be invited. I'd much prefer to be in Waterloo, but we'll do what we can now. So I'm going to be talking mostly about talking about these two papers, one that came out in February and one that's coming out this month or next with collaboration with Don Marolf. I guess let's jump straight into it. So I'll start by talking about what sort of motivated this work, and it's something that a lot of people have been writing papers about and excited about in the last year or so. So hopefully it shouldn't need too much introduction to most of you. With that kind of motivation and background under our belt, I'll talk a bit about the sort of way of thinking about these things and combining this with some old stuff from the 80s by Coleman and Giddings and Strominger and others to put this in some broader context. Finally, I'll talk about stuff that's mostly going to be in this paper that hasn't come out yet, which is really applying this specifically back to the information problem that motivated it. So before I start, I should say that if anyone has questions at any point, or then they should absolutely feel free to interrupt and ask at any point. So I'm very happy to, if I don't get through everything because there are lots of questions, then I'm happy to do that. So do interrupt at any time. Okay, so let's start talking about some of this background that's been in the last year or so. So here's an old kind of thought experiment from the 70s, where, you know, it goes back to Hawking. Imagine forming a black hole from some pure state of matter. So we've thrown in some photons or something to make ourselves a black hole. We wait for that black hole to evaporate into Hawking radiation, and we collect all that radiation. And then we ask about what that radiation looks like. So this is a kind of diagnostic of what's going on, is to ask what is the entropy of, say, the radiation at any particular time during the evaporation, or equivalently the entropy of the black hole. So actually I've given you several different notions of entropy on this graph. So the x-axis is time, starting with our initial black hole and going to the very end of evaporation. And on the y-axis, we've got various notions of entropy. So the first curve to look at is this red curve. And that's the thermal entropy of the black hole. So it's a coarse-grained entropy that says we know we have a black hole of a particular mass, but we don't know exactly what quantum state it's in. We don't know necessarily the fine-grained details. So how many states are there that are consistent with a black hole of that mass, let's say? And that's just going to be given by the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So, and our black hole first collapses, it's big, and then as it evaporates, it reduces in size, so the thermal entropy decreases. You shouldn't take the shape of these curves too seriously. For a real black hole, it's not going to be just a straight line, but the general trend is the important thing. So the second entropy is this green curve, and that's again a thermal coarse grained entropy, but now of the radiation. So we have radiation at a certain temperature. We don't know the precise quantum state, but we can ask how many states are compatible with that coarse grained information that we have radiation at a certain temperature. And that's this green curve, and we start off without any radiation, and there's just more and more radiation coming out, so the curve just goes up and up and up. The final one is this black curve, and that is what we expect for a fine-grained entropy, so the von Neumann entropy of either the black hole or the radiation. So if we have a very generic system, which is a quantum mechanical unitary system, we know that the total state is pure. We started with this pure state of matter. So that means that the entropy of the black hole is the same as the entropy of the radiation that's come out. It's the entanglement entropy, if you like, between the two. And very generically, you expect it to go up for a while following the thermal radiation and then down again. So it's the nature of these thermal radiations are a maximum that's consistent with the coarse-grained information. So these, both the green curve and the red curve provide a bound on the von Neumann entropy, an upper bound. So we know the black curve has to lie below both the green curve and the red curve. And under very generic circumstances with a sort of random Hamiltonian, for example, actually the von Neumann entropy is going to follow very, very closely to whichever bound is tighter. And that means it goes up for a while, and then there's this sort of phase transition, and it comes down again. And this was first pointed out as a sharp diagnostic of unitarity by Don Page, and in particular, we call this time where the curve starts coming down the Page time. So this is very general discussion, but in the context of black holes, we can start assigning these various curves, various names. So this is the Page curve. This is the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And the green curve is, of course, what Hawking got from his calculation for the state of radiation. And that's a problem, because if we have a unitary quantum mechanics, then we know that the black curve is the entropy we expect. And in particular, the red curve will provide a bound on the entropy. So there's, as soon as you hit the Page time, there's a sharp tension that needs to be resolved somehow. And that's the information problem. So the new development that's happened a year or so ago was papers by came out simultaneously by Jeff Pennington at Stanford and by Santa Barbarians and ex-Santa Barbarians, Ahmed, Netta, Don, and I. And what we actually discovered was that just using semi-classical physics, not using any UV complete stuff or anything like that, you can actually recover this Page curve. So we'd like to try and understand how that works better. So let's just quickly review where that Page curve came from. I'm not going to go into all the details, but just give a sort of outline on the background. The key thing we used was this quantum version of the Rutaki and Agi formula. So what this tells us is that in the right context, this S of rho is a fine-grained von Neumann entropy of a density matrix. So it's minus trace of rho log rho. So it's really this black curve from the previous slide. To compute that in a gravitational system in the right context, you have to, first of all, think about this generalized entropy quantity. So that generalized entropy is defined as basically what Bekenstein defined as a generalized entropy many years ago. There's this geometric piece, which involves an area, and then there's a matter entropy piece. And I've defined it on this sigma, which is a partial Cauchy surface, so it's some space-like slice that's... But it doesn't have to be a Cauchy surface for the entire space-time. It can have some edge. Question, I think.
Hey. Should these two terms be thought of as the first two terms of some expansion in powers of G Newton?
So you can certainly think about it this way. But the it goes back to. Let's see if I get the right citation. Really, you should. This whole quantity. It's supposed to be UV finite and cutoff independent in the end. So it's natural to think about this as being some leading order classical piece, and this is a one loop quantum correction, and there might be higher loops. But really, this is supposed to be some UV finite all loop quantity. So in particular, a one loop, we know that G Newton gets renormalized. But also this term is divergent, and the sum of the two is actually UV finite and regulator independent. So there's not really, once you include quantum corrections, there's not a clean split between these two terms. It's only the sum that is well defined, and that that will continue to higher orders. And so this goes, this is essentially the same as arguments of Susskind and Uglum in the 90s, I guess.
So if the second term sort of is the same order as the first in some situations, do I need to worry about all the other terms?
So the end result of that was that really this is everything you need. So this is both quantities will get contributions at all loops. So this quantity has contributions starting with a classical piece and then has corrections at all loops. This will start with the one loop piece and has corrections at all loops beyond that. But the combination, the sum, There's not some extra two loop term that comes in. Otherwise, this already contains two loops, three loops, and so forth. I'm not sure this is. The way to understand that is this really comes from, this is the quantity you get naturally from so in the black hole context, if you do the something like a Gibbons Hawking calculation of a black hole entropy, then this is the term you get where you, instead of just using the classical Einstein-Hilbert action, you use the full quantum effective action of the theory. Then this is just a way of a suggestive way of writing the that in that the full contribution to all loops.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have this generalized entropy quantity, and it's defined on a partial Cauchy surface, and that partial Cauchy surface can potentially end somewhere at finite distance in space time, and any time it ends, you should include this geometric area piece. And then you have the entropy of the matter that lives on this partial Cauchy slice. And then once we've computed this generalized entropy for all possible candidate Cauchy surfaces, we vary this sigma, and we look for an extremum. So we look for something that's stationary under the first order variations. So that's the extremum. And then if we have several different extrema, we should choose the one that for which this is minimal. Okay, so that's the recipe. I won't tell you in detail how we get it, but I'll give some brief outline in a moment. Okay, so let's just apply the recipe in this context, an evaporating black hole. So here in the bottom right is a Penrose diagram with ADS asymptotics of definiteness, but it doesn't really matter too much. And I've drawn this blue slice, which is some Cauchy slice through the space-time, and there's some Hawking radiation that's come out, and then these ingoing little arrows are supposed to be the Hawking partners of the Hawking radiation. So these two guys are, roughly speaking, in some maximally mixed state, and these two guys are in some maximally mixed state. And at the top here, I've drawn a picture of the spatial geometry of this blue slice. So you've got some, it becomes very large near the ADS boundary, the asymptotic boundary. Then you have an event horizon, and inside the event horizon, the geometry is roughly a sort of cylinder of constant width. And these little green arrows on the inside are supposed to represent the internal states of these Hawking partner things that have gone in. And as time evolves, this event horizon, that's the boundary to this long piece is becoming smaller as the black hole evaporates. Simply the fact that the horizon is decreasing area as it loses mass. And then you have this large interior. And there's some entropy of the matter that is in this interior. And this matter is basically the Hawking partners that are falling into the black hole. And roughly speaking, this is growing sort of over fairly long time periods, is growing roughly linearly in time. So for each thermal time, you create a single new Hawking partner, and that adds to the radiation, adds to the entropy. Okay, so that's a picture of the space-time. So let's now apply this formula of the previous slide where we look at this generalized entropy for various things. So the first partial Cauchy surface that we can consider is actually the whole Cauchy surface. Then there's no area piece. The only piece we have to worry about is the entropy of the matter, and that's this roughly linearly growing entropy term. But on the other hand, the new discovery was that actually there's another candidate quantum extremal surface as the extrema of this generalized entropy functional accord, and that's where we just decide to terminate this at the horizon, or close to the horizon. And then there's no real matter piece to include. So I should say we've got some sort of transparent boundary conditions, so the early Hawking partners can escape, which means that there's very little matter in this exterior region. So the matter entropy is sort of negligible or order one. And the only piece we have to worry about is this area term. So those are the two candidates. And putting these two together, the guy on the left This gives you this matter entropy, gives you the green curve that increases for all time, gives you Hawking's answer. It's basically the same as Hawking's calculation. But this new quantum extremal surface gives us this red curve, which decreases with time, which is the coarse-grained entropy of the black hole. So putting these two things together and using the recipe, this Ruta-Kanagi recipe, you find we get the page curve. Okay. But this sort of asks more questions than... I should ask if there are any questions on that sort of lightning review before proceeding. Okay, good. Okay, so this asks more questions than it answers in some ways, which is a nice situation to be in. Hopefully you can learn something. So the first question I'm going to ask is... and give some sort of answer to, is that we have this growing interior with a large entropy and many, many possible internal states. And yet, despite the fact that we have this potentially large number of internal states inside this long throat in an evaporating black hole, we find this fine-grained entropy is much less than the number of internal states we have. So this seems problematic and demands some explanation. And the answer I'm going to try to motivate today is that actually these apparently independent states in the interior here, with it looks like every Hawking partner I could choose to flip this qubit from up to down and change its state, but really I'd like to motivate that there's all these non-trivial relationships in the Hilbert space, and actually many of these seemingly independent states are actually linearly dependent. And this is a sort of relation we see in gauge theories, where you start with some set of configurations where we haven't imposed the constraints, and then we have some sort of unphysical Hilbert space, and then we impose constraints afterwards, and we have these sort of equivalence relations. And I want to motivate that these equivalence relations are in some sense do arise from a gauge symmetry, which is basically diffeomorphism invariance, but it's the non-perturbative effect of diffeomorphism invariance that arises only when you have topology change. So that's what I'll try to motivate. The second thing I'll hopefully get to at the end is to talk about, go and revisit the question of really what does semi-classical gravity predict for if you do some experiment with some black hole, what does it predict the answers will be? And I'd like to, in the light of these sort of new developments, go back to that question. And the answer I'd like to give is that really predicts that an observer will think that Hawking radiation is pure. And the argument for this is really the same as the argument that Polchinski and Stromer gave in 94 that I'll give a version of later. But the new thing is that to really show that this follows the page curve and how you can see that. And so this, for example, Polchinski and Strominger talked to some extent about remnants and about all the information coming out at the very end of evaporation, and there were some difficulties with that. But really, we're going to see that this new ingredient allows us to predict that an observer will see a page curve. But what it doesn't do, even though it predicts that there'll be a pure state, it doesn't tell you which pure state. And how that's, we'll see as we go along how that's actually compatible. Okay, so the last piece of the introduction is to remind ourselves where this Ruta-Kanagi formula came from. And this was emphasized very nicely in these two papers of last December, the East Coast paper of Almeri Hartmann, Maldacena, Shigulian, and Tajdini, and the West Coast paper of Pennington, Schenker, Stanford, and Yang. And they really emphasized this point that the Ruta-Kanagi formula is something you derive from a path integral for these Renyi entropies, or the trace of a density matrix to the nth power. And this density matrix to the nth power involves n copies of your system, and you do a gravitational path integral with boundary conditions suitable for n copies. So on the left side, I've stolen these figures from this paper. So here's six boundaries. This is the n equals six version. And these folks pointed out that the geometries that are relevant for this new page curve result are things that connect together the boundaries in this kind of way. So these boundaries they're effectively disconnected gravitational boundaries, but they're connected together through through the geometry that's dynamically chosen by the path integral. And this is a version with n equals 2 as well. So the thing to look at here is this shaded region, and this shaded region is the place where the gravitational geometry lives. And this gravitational geometry has two boundaries, this circle at the top and this circle at the bottom, and they're joined. And there's one way that is going to find, useful to, is this working? There it is. Yeah. Find useful to talk about this kind of picture is to read this with time running upwards. And I'm not sure if you can see it, but I've drawn a little blue circle here. So this is supposed to be a kind of Cauchy slice. And this is I want to think of this as an intermediate state of a closed universe. And this is I'm going to call this closed universe a baby universe, because I started with some ADS asymptotics and did some experiment. And during that experiment, I created this closed baby universe, which propagated and then joined onto this other ADS asymptotic. So I've got these two parent universes, which spawn this baby between them. And then this relates back to old work of Coleman and Giddings and Strominger, which we want to try to kind of fold into the picture. And also I'll mention briefly this a recent paper by Sadchenker and Stanford, and all of these pictures look extremely similar to one another, and we're going to kind of tie them together in this next section. So I'll pause again for any questions. Okay, good. So the strategy now is that we have these replicable wormholes that are important. So now in the kind of context of ADS-CFT and things like this, we'd like to revisit this old picture of Coleman and Giddings and Strominger that people may be familiar with, that describes how these kind of topology-changing processes where you split off and join with little closed baby universes, and how you should think about physics in that context. Okay, so let's jump into that. See what the time is. Okay, we're doing well. I want to talk about this in the context where we have the most control, which is in ADS asymptotics. And what I'm going to be talking about mostly is really just gravitational. But before we do that, it's nice to have some kind of dual perspective for what we're doing. So one of our favorite ways of thinking about gravity in the last 20-something years is through ADS-CFT. And we expect that if we do a gravitational path integral with ADS asymptotics, so we have some bulk fields phi, the metric, and some other matter fields. So this includes the metric. And we have boundary conditions for these fields at ADS asymptotics. And we do this path integral, then that should be giving us some quantity in a CFT, something I'll call a partition function. As a general, sort of very generalized partition function with sources turned on for any operators that we might like. So these sources will include, for example, a boundary metric, which provides boundary conditions for the bulk metric, and maybe some insertions of operators and so forth. Okay. But now, if we have these space-time wormholes that the replicable wormholes are an example of, this is a problem. Because if I compute the partition function on some manifold that's a disjoint union of two manifolds, so here I've drawn one circle at the top and another circle at the bottom, if I really had some dual quantum field theory, then the partition function on a disconnected geometry is just the product of partition functions on, so we expect this left-hand side to be equal to this right-hand side. It should just be decomposed into a product. But if I have these sorts of geometries that connect the two, and it seems there's nothing obvious in the gravitational path integral that prevents us from that, then this spoils this and we don't get this equality anymore. So this demands an explanation. This is a problem that people have grappled with for some time. And And it's now being really sharpened because there's these examples that do something really nice for us that we like, this page curve, but we really need to explain this. Okay. And we'll give some interpretation for what this might mean later. But for now, I'll just talk about the bulk path integral, but I'm going to use this notation. So for now, this left-hand side here is a definition, is defined, I should say, by the right-hand side. So for example, here I've got z of j1, z of j2, z of j3. Each of these z's denotes some boundary condition. So this means some, say, d-dimensional spatial or t-dimensional boundary metric and sources and so forth. Each of these z's is some disconnected component of the boundary. And these angle brackets, for now, they just mean do the path integral with those boundary conditions. Okay. And our aim now is to give some Hilbert space interpretation of this. So I can imagine trying to insert some complete set of states that live on this blue size, some sense, some state psi, and they'll live in some Hilbert space that I'll call the Hilbert space of baby universes. So that's what we're going to do. So if you just try to do this directly, this is, of course, quite a difficult problem because you've got to gauge fix diffeomorphisms. So here, if I was just in a quantum field theory, I could fix the slice and think about wave functions as being, about these states as being functionals of the fields. But of course, I've now got diffeomorphism invariants, so I can move this slice anywhere. And these should be regarded as equivalent states, or I've got some Wheeler-DeWitt equation that I have to impose to include the diffeomorphism constraints. And that's challenging enough in the first place, but we've now got topology change as well, and topology change only makes that harder. So this is quite a hard problem, but we're going to completely get around it by using a sort of axiomatic approach. So we're going to use these amplitudes and suppose that someone has told us all the amplitudes. They're very good at physics and have done the path integral over every possible boundary condition for us. And they've told us this set of numbers, and we're going to build the Hilbert space from that numbers. And this is very much like how you might axiomatically construct a quantum field theory Hilbert space using, say, Euclidean correlation functions in the sort of Whiteman way. Okay, so I'll pause again for questions. This is going to be our strategy. Okay. Good. Okay, so what are we going to use to build this? So on the bottom, I've drawn the same amplitude that we computed before, but now I've just foliated it with a load of these slices where we're going to think about inserting complete sets of states. So I can draw this, or I can sort of read this picture from bottom to top. I start with some state at the very, very bottom, and to the past of that, so to speak, there are no asymptotic boundaries. So this is, I can think of this state as being prepared by doing a path integral where I don't include any boundaries whatsoever. I'll clarify that in a little bit in a moment. Then I want to move to this second slice, but between the first slice and the second slice, I've included this boundary down here, this z of j1. And this z of j1, then I can think of as an operator that I started with this no boundary state. I've inserted this operator, and now I've got a new state on this slice. Then I have another boundary, which I insert, and that's, again, changed the state on this third slice. A third boundary changed the state on this slice. And then finally, I take the overlap with a final state, which is another no boundary state. So this is just, okay, this is the kind of picture we're going to do. And in this way, we can build every possible amplitude, every possible one of these amplitudes, just using this no boundary state and using these operators that create boundaries. And so you can think of this as being analogous to a vacuum state and local operators in quantum field theory. I should say that this no boundary state, I've called it HH for the Hardle-Hawking state, because it really is the same boundary conditions as Hardle and Hawking used. The only novelty is that in the usual context, people think about the Hardle-Hawking state for the universe, say, for a single component of the universe, say some three-sphere, and you work out the wave function of the volume of that three-sphere and so forth. Whereas here, we're allowing this universe to have any number of components. So in particular, it can have no components, So the Hadron-Hawking state might just not create anything whatsoever. It might create one universe. So this final state, for example, I've chosen to slice it in such a way that this sort of Cauchy slice passes through a single closed universe here. And it could have multiple universes. Okay. Good. Okay, so this is just writing in equations the words I gave in that last slide. We can interpret this amplitude, which is to say the path integral with three boundaries, as this quantum mechanical sort of Hilbert space picture where we have a Hadron-Hawking state, insert these operators, and then we have a final Hadron-Hawking state. The only other ingredient we need is to define what we mean by an inner product is we need to know what Hermitian conjugation is on these operators. And so this we'll just take as being some external thing that we impose, but we should think of this as being like a CPT conjugation on the sources. So this is this J star is, roughly speaking, we should reverse, we should do some time and space reverse and flip all the charges of operators that live on these boundaries. But this is just some extra piece I impose. And then I'm just going to assert, which is basically a definition of the Hilbert space, that that we start with this Hadron-Hawking state. That's one state in our Hilbert space. We have these operators that creates other states, and that basically I can get everything like that. So I can act on these. I can take these linear combinations of these states where I act with these z's on the Hadron-Hawking state. I can act with z any number of times, and then I can also take superpositions. Okay, so this seems like an assumption, but really it's, I can say more words if people ask, but let's just assert that for now. Don't want to get too sidetracked. Okay, so this is almost enough to actually give us a Hilbert space, but we have to put in one assumption. And that assumption is, again, is something you'd need in again, it's familiar from this construction in quantum field theory, is we need to assume that the inner product of states we built this way is positive semi-definite. So in other words, we have all these possible states acting with the operators on the Hadron-Hawking state. We have this inner product, which is defined by just CPT conjugating on the boundaries in the bra piece. And we ask that if we take any linear combination psi of these states and compute its norm using this inner product, we shouldn't get a negative number ever. And then you just define the Hilbert space of closed universes by the span of these states with this inner product and complete that. And this is a sort of familiar construction. And now we have as long as we know how to compute the amplitudes of our theory, which is obviously not an easy task, but in principle, at least we have a definition of the Hilbert space where we never had to talk about diffeomorphism invariants, imposing constraints and so forth. Okay, what else am I going to say? Okay, any questions on the construction? This is the most challenging bit, so if anyone has a... Okay.
Oh, actually, can I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Okay, so like in your construction, I mean, it seems like a very important ingredient is that you have a boundary to define your theory on, right? So that you have these. And so maybe this is jumping ahead a bit, but can you just like say something like, or do you have an idea of what to do if you don't have them, say like for flat space or?
Well, so for flat space, I think it's not so bad. I think you can define, you need somewhere to, somewhere firm to put your feet, so to speak. And in flat space, I think sort of scry plus and scry minus can play that role if you have asymptotically flat boundary conditions. And if you have positive cosmological constant, then you could try playing the same game and applying the same words, except now these pictures, you can sort of think about them as being Euclidean. It's not totally necessary, we'll see, but you can think of them as being Euclidean. And in the positive cosmological constant context, you might instead think of these pictures being Lorentzian, and these are the asymptotic past or asymptotic future. And hopefully at some point we'll finish writing a paper about the De Sitter case, how you should interpret it as well there. But you really need somewhere to put boundary conditions that you understand.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is actually a problem in De Sitter because of if you don't expect De Sitter to be eternally stable and so forth. But okay, that's another story. Okay, any other questions?
Sorry, can you say a bit more about what you said about stability of the sitter and how? Yeah, I mean, if you can.
Very briefly. So in ADS asymptotics, what do I want to say? It'll probably take us a little bit too far afield, but
that's okay.
I can say one sentence actually. Mm-hmm. Let's say, think of this as a future De Sitter boundary. In the ADS context, we think we have control over what's going on near this boundary, and we can use the usual sort of holographic normalization prescription to define our boundary conditions. Whereas in De Sitter, if it's some asymptotic future, if De Sitter is not absolutely stable, then any patch is going to just decay to some other vacuum eternally. So it means that I can't just say my boundary condition is that I get to some final De Sitter phase, because we have this infinite set of phase transitions that are going to happen in the infinite amount of time before we reach the boundary. I'm not sure if that was clarifying. But, okay.
Thank you.
We have this Hilbert space that we've constructed. So the next step is to try and understand our amplitudes with the Hilbert space interpretation. And for this, we just need to make one kind of almost trivial observation. And that observation is that any two of these boundary operators, these boundary creating operators we've defined, actually commute in this Hilbert space. And this, from the sort of abstract definitions, this is just the fact that the definition of this sort of amplitude doesn't include any kind of ordering. It's just you do the path integral with these three boundaries, and there's no inherent ordering in those. And in pictures, I can decide that I'm going to insert this slice down here with the insertion of J1 before J2, or I can choose a different slice here. And I get the same answer, whichever slicing I choose. Because all these operators commute, since first time you did quantum mechanics, you have a sort of gut feeling that you want to try to simultaneously diagonalize a complete set of commuting operators. So we'll do that. We have a Hilbert space, we have these commuting operators. So we just choose, we know there are these special states alpha that are simultaneous eigenstates of all these operators. And furthermore, you can show from our construction that these states alpha are really an orthonormal basis of the Bayer universe Hilbert space. So there's this special distinguished basis of states. And we've called these alpha states because they're very analogous to what Coleman described as alpha states in his work in the 80s, except now we didn't actually have to apply any approximations or anything to get there. This is really a sort of exact statement from this definition from our first principles, sort of axiomatic definition of this Bayer universe Hilbert space. Okay, so how are we now to interpret this?
Henry, can I?
Yes.
So you drew the analogy with Coleman's wormholes in the alpha. That your alpha is a real parameter, is that right?
Or and so our alphas, if I've been very, we don't know much about the alphas so far. So it could contain any number of real parameters or discrete parameters. So now when I said this is an orthonormal basis, some of these might be delta function normalized. So we have a toy example that I won't talk about very much, where some of these alpha parameters are continuous and some of them are discrete. We generally expect that there's probably going to be infinitely many of these parameters.
Okay, thanks.
I can say maybe a little bit more in the in a, another context what the alpha parameters are, but the end of this slide. Okay, so let's, given the this construction and the this nice alpha basis, let's interpret this amplitude that we started with. So we wrote it in this quantum mechanical way, and now we have this complete set of alpha states, so we'll just throw in a complete set of states between every pair of operators. And because these guys are their eigenstates of these operators, we just get a product of the, a sum over the eigenstates, a product of the eigenvalues, and then some weighting. And this weighting I've written down here is just the overlap of the alpha state with the Hartle-Hawking state. So this is now easy to interpret because we have some definite numbers, Z of J, but our quantity is computed by this weighted sum. So we should think of these Z of J's not as being definite numbers, but rather random variables. And there's some probability space spanned by these alphas, and this angle brackets we can interpret as an average in that ensemble of alphas. So that means that every alpha, every one of these special states in the Hilbert space of baby universes, is dual to a single dual CFT, if you like. So any alpha state has a definite value for all the partition functions for these Z alphas. There's a definite number, and in particular, this factorization problem. If I set up the baby universes in an alpha state, we don't have this factorization problem because they're eigenstates, the different boundaries don't talk to one another anymore. And this is very similar to the alpha states and the sort of ensembles that we've talked about in Coleman and Giddings and Strominger. And we now really know of at least one example of ADS CFT that really seems to do this. And this was in this beautiful paper of a recent paper by Sadchenko and Stanford that showed that Jakiev tidal buoyant gravity at least seems to be have this interpretation where the dual theory is not doesn't have some single Hamiltonian, but rather is describing an ensemble of Hamiltonians. And then the alphas here just label all the possible Hamiltonians. So particularly you can think of the alpha parameters as just being the individual energy eigenstates. And this average is a weighting over all the possible collections of energies in that Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is how we can interpret now ADS-CFT with these wormholes, if they're gonna be in the game. Okay, any more questions? Okay, so the next thing is, one more comment before the next thing, which is that it turns out, and I'll hopefully give a little motivation for this, that null states are a very important thing here. So we started off with these states, these sort of basis states for the Hilbert space. But it was certainly a possibility that this space was overcomplete, and in particular that there would be linear dependencies like this. And in fact, we think that these linear dependencies are extremely important. So we'll give you one version of that in a moment. And if these are there, we want to interpret these as these gauge equivalents they advertised before under diffeomorphisms, which are, so roughly speaking, these kind of linear relations are coming about because of these topology changing processes. And something we'd like to make more precise, but at least interpretively, it seems reasonable to associate this with some extension of diffeomorphism invariance. So one motivation of this comes from a toy model that that I'm not going to talk about today. So you can read section 3 of our paper, or if anyone wants the link, Don has a recorded seminar for the IT from Qubit that's online where he talks mostly about this toy model. So if anyone's interested, then there's another place they can look. And I'll share the link if anyone wants. The last comment I'll make about these sorts of linear relations is that they're not just non-perturbative in Newton's constant. So any one topology changing process we generally expect to be non-perturbative. So it goes like e to the minus 1 over g Newton. But these come from really an infinite sum over sort of resumming all these topology changing processes, which means they're doubly exponential. And this is a feature that's discussed quite a lot in this JT gravity model. So this is a kind of novel and interesting sort of effect that for certain quantities is extremely important. Okay, so for one version of these null states, we're going to go back, this is going to be relevant for black holes. So we're going last circling back to where we started. So before I give that kind of argument, I need to talk about slightly different Hilbert spaces in this construction. So far we've talked about these closed universes. So that's what this Hilbert, baby universe Hilbert space was. But I could also imagine trying to have some complete set of states on a slice like this that passes through a boundary. So I'd like to, I've got some sort of D minus one manifold sigma, which is in this case, 2 points, which is the intersection of my red boundary manifold with the with my sort of blue slice where my intermediate states live. So this is we'll call this D minus one manifold sigma. And we've got this Hilbert space H sigma, which is the space of states in the Hilbert space with a boundary. Okay, so just some sort of notation. If I have, so the kind of states that might live in this Hilbert space is anything that I would imagine doing in a CFT to create a state. So I'm going to use this notation where I have this black line as an ADS asymptotic boundary. Perhaps it should have been red to match these, but it's some piece of an ADS asymptotic boundary that ends, so this point is supposed to be the manifold sigma. And then there's some insertion in the past here that's creating some bulk state. So I could, one example of this would be in ADS CFT, this black curve is a hemisphere and I insert some operator OI in the south pole of this hemisphere. And that's just creating a state in, or will be creating a state in the CFT using the state's operator correspondence. And it's maybe there's some particle that lives in ADS that's labeled by this green dots and has some label I associated with it. So this is, these are the sort of things I can create that have a single asymptotic ADS region. So these will be guys in the sigma Hilbert space. But I could also include some of these closed universes. So up here, for example, this blue state, I should think of as being one of these kind of boundaries with where I sort of have some cut here on the boundary sigma, but it's also this closed universe that's changing the state as well. So I've also got these in the Hilbert space. And now if I apply the same logic that got us these alpha states before, the same kind of thing shows us that this sigma Hilbert space actually diagonalizes into alpha sectors, but there's a Hilbert space for each alpha sector. So it decomposes into a direct sum of basically super selection sectors labeled by the alphas. Okay. And so the original baby universe is a special case of this where you take sigma to be the empty set. Okay, so we can do something with this. There's a reason I've introduced this. And that's because I want to talk about these Hilbert spaces, these H sigma alphas, and think about one particular set of states in there that I can create, which are things created by collapsing a black hole and then coupling the system to some auxiliary system, allowing the black hole to evaporate and decrease in size. So I'm trying to create some states that involve this old black hole with a very, very large interior. And this old black hole with a large interior is where we got confused earlier about the entropy of what was happening to these interior states. So I'd like to think about these states I as being some states of the old black hole where I perhaps labels the state of the Hawking partners. Okay, so we're going to give an argument about how many independent states there can be in these Hilbert spaces. So the argument goes as follows. I consider this delta, and this delta is a state in the Hilbert space with two boundaries now. And the first guy, which I'll notate like this, is a boundary condition that involves a cylinder, which joins the two sigmas. So this is the sort of boundary condition you would use to create a two-sided eternal black hole, sort of thermofield double state in ADS-CFT. So, and I'm doing a version of this argument that is sort of at infinite temperature, so to speak. There's a version that includes energies and temperatures and so forth that I'm just sort of, for simplicity, we're just removing that, but you can see the details in the paper. So that's the first piece, is this two-sided kind of cylinder boundary condition. And then the other piece is going to be a product of one-sided states. And I'm just going to, before I write this, I've chosen to diagonalize things so that if I try to take the overlap between any two of these states, I and J, then these are actually orthonormal. And I'm saying there are going to be K of these orthonormal states. And what we'd like to do is say something about K and how large that can be. Okay, so we've diagonalized these guys. And now what we want to do is compute the norm of delta. So the first term in the norm of delta involves the inner product of this term with itself. So that involves taking some cylinder, gluing it to some other cylinder, and this gluing gives us means we end up with the thermal circle. So this is like a geometry that's S1 times sigma, if you like. And that is the thing that we would use to compute the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole. So we expect this to be given by the area of the horizon. The second term involves inner products between this guy and this guy, which just gives me this diagonal inner product. And the third term involves inner products between two of these guys. So that involves two boundaries. We've written the answer down here. So we've got the first term, which I've already discussed. Then there's the second term, so that you get minus 2k from this piece and k from this piece. So I'm putting out one piece of this. But there's something left over, which is because these two boundaries don't factorize necessarily, we could have things joining here. You actually end up with what I'll call the variance. So this is the amplitude for the square of this boundary conditions minus the square of the amplitude, where it's the connected piece of this amplitude. So the last thing we're going to do is impose that this is positive. But because of this term here, we can't really say very much. What we expect each of these individual terms, the connected piece of this amplitude, to be very small, to be non-perturbatively suppressed. But there's potentially many, many terms here. There's k squared terms. So it means we can't say very much. But what we can do is just put alphas everywhere. So I don't want to talk about the two-sided Hilbert space H sigma union sigma, but this diagonalized version where I put an alpha state. I choose my basis, so these get diagonalized in one of my alpha sectors. All these alphas go everywhere. And once I'm in an alpha sector, variances vanish, because then we don't have this factorization problem. So what we learn is that this E to the entropy, Bekenstein-Hawking piece, has to be bigger than this K. And this K now is basically the dimension of this Hilbert space H sigma alpha. It's the number of guys I could choose to be linearly independent. So it's the number of terms that are consistent with this condition. So what we learn is that even though it looked naively like we could create many, many states here, we could create all of these different old black holes with different states of the Hawking partners in the interior, it turns out that they're actually, there's these sort of gauge equivalences we were talking about between them. There are many, many, many null states of this form, many null states. And the existence of these null states is not obvious at all. They look completely random, but you'd have sort of exponentially many terms in here, and there wouldn't be any obvious way these relations come about. But we'd know they have to be there by this reflection positivity argument. If there's a consistent quantum mechanical description of the bulk with a Hilbert space and a positive definite norm, then we know these null states have to be there. Despite the fact that there seem to be many, many independent states that's not bounded by the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, despite that, it turns out they're actually linearly dependent between them. And this then guarantees the page curve, not just sort of on average, but really in every alpha sector. Okay, so that's our the first result I wanted to get to. And before I make the last few comments in the last 5 minutes, again, I'll invite any questions. Okay, so for the last bit, we won't need too much of all those details of what have come before, but we're just going to be talking about sort of Hawking's calculation and revisiting those semi-classical predictions that come from gravity for what the Hawking calculation looks like. So what we're going to try to be computing is a wave function of the radiation, psi r. So we're imagining for now that we're going to create a black hole, allow it to evaporate completely, look at the radiation state, and these psi irs are I as some simple basis. So we have boundary conditions. So this psi ri is some components of the radiation wave function that we can create, that we can think of as being computed by a boundary condition where we have some initial state of the black hole, some matter that we're throwing in that I'm going to just fix once and for all. There's some long time evolution. And then when the black hole is evaporated completely, we're going to project this onto some simple state of diffuse Hawking radiation. So this defines some boundary condition. Psi ri defines some boundary condition for the path integral. So let's try to just compute the path integral with this boundary condition. This is kind of what we'd be instructed to do in ADS-CFT, for example, is you'd want to do the path integral with this boundary condition. But there's no obvious way to do this just using semi-classical gravity. So the first thing you can try to do is draw the spacetime, the usual spacetime of evaporating black hole on the left here, and say that that is a saddle point for this path integral. But it's not really a valid saddle point. And the reason is that when we do the integral over bulk matter fields, we don't know what to do up here with the singularity. We don't know what weight we should use to integrate over the matter fields here. Roughly speaking, we need some boundary condition to impose here, and there's no real guidance as to what we should do. So there's not a semi-classical calculation that just computes these components. But undeterred, let's try and compute, see what we can do. So let's use a sort of in-in formalism. So that means that when we're doing an in-in formalism, instead of perhaps we want to measure some simple observable. So this means that we have a sort of bra and a ket state and some observable in the middle, and everything we can compute is encoded in really the density matrix of the radiation. And the density matrix of the radiation involves the bra piece and a ket piece, which means it involves two of these boundaries, one conjugated with respect to the other. And now there is a calculation we can do. The calculation involves taking two copies of the spacetime, one that's associated with the bra and one that's associated with the ket. We use the normal Hawking spacetime, except we glue them together along some slice that just covers the interior of the black hole. And now that means the important thing is this region to the future of that slice is actually excluded from our saddle point geometry. It doesn't matter. We're not doing the path integral over the singularity. So we never need to know what goes on there. This is actually just the same as Hawking's calculation. This is just Hawking's calculation in path integral language. So instead, he might say, well, you compute the evolution of all the states, and then you trace out the interior of the black hole. But really, this tracing out of the interior is, in path integral language, it's like doing a Schwinger-Keldysh contour that goes up in time until you hit this blue curve, then it jumps to the second piece and goes back in time again. So this is really the usual Schwinger-Keldysh way of doing path integrals. It's just that the gravitational part of the system kind of dynamically chooses which contour you do the path integral on. And there's only one place where it fails to be semi-classical, which is the very end point of evaporation. And that's sort of a time independent. It doesn't matter how big the black hole was, and that stays the same. So we're only going to assume the black hole does evaporate for now. So that needn't worry us. Okay. So famously, Hawking got a mixed state for this result. You get something thermal. And from our point of view, we can write this as the final state as being an entangled state between between our radiation and some baby universes. And here the baby universe is essentially the black hole interior. And then the entanglement with the baby universes is what gives us a mixed state. So it looks like we have information loss. I might just say, sort of in passing here, that that this formulation makes it clear that there's a sense in which Hawking's calculation involves two boundaries, and it's a kind of two replica calculation, and there's a space-time wormhole, because this boundary for the Bra and a boundary for the Ket, they're not connected to one another in the boundary, but they are connected dynamically through the space-time, through the tracing out of the baby universe, if you like. So there's a sense in which Hawking's calculation actually does involve a space-time wormhole already, and a sense in which the information paradox is really a version, a specific example of this factorization problem, understanding why we have this two-sided quantity that we can't write as a product of one-sided quantities. Okay, how are we doing for time? Oh, not very well. Okay, well, we're nearly there. Hopefully you'll indulge me with another 2 minutes. Okay, so we came to the conclusion that the state was mixed. But if we actually wanted to verify that experimentally, we can't do that using a single copy of the system. You need to, if you want to really experimentally verify that there's a mixed state, you need several copies. So a simple way to do this is the swap test, which involves taking two sets of the radiation. So you have rho tensor rho, and you apply the operator S. And the operator S is just the thing that swaps the two systems. And the result of that is the trace of rho squared. It's called the purity. And whether this is one or not will tell you whether your radiation is pure. And you can very, very quickly tell in an experiment if your radiation is mixed or pure. Okay, so let's compute this using the path integral. So the obvious thing to do is you just say, hey, I've got two density matrices. I've got two copies of the thing. I just do the obvious thing. I just take two copies of the whole path integral. And that way I would get two copies of Hawking's rate, of Hawking's calculation. But as pointed out by Polchinski and Strominger, there's another subtle point that's just as good here. And that's where I just choose that my first copy and my second copy, I swap the interiors, so to speak. So I, there's a way to describe this in Hilbert space language, is I should regard the black hole interiors as being like bosons. They're indistinguishable, which means that when I trace out the interiors and I have two interiors and trace them out, I should include two possible permutations. So I have these two subtle points. And these are, again, this is just a copy of the Hawking calculation. It's just that the there's a funny way that the labels on the external things are rearranged relative to the interiors of the black holes. So the result of this calculation, semi-classically, is that I don't just have n copies of Hawking's calculation, if I did this n times instead of two, but I include this projection onto the states that are completely symmetric amongst the n copies. And from the sort of general considerations earlier, you can show that you could write this, this sort of state as being entangled with the baby universes, but there's n copies of the same state entangled with any particular baby universe state, which is different from this thing I've drawn on the left-hand side. So the thing I've drawn on the left-hand side is what would give you n copies of a mixed state. Here I have sort of n copies of a pure state, but I don't know which pure state. And from this, you can actually see the information loss is completely unobservable. So if you were to do the swap test, for example, it would be as if the state were pure. The final slide, is to say that the replicable wormholes are really just a version of this Polchinski-Strominger calculation, but before the black hole evaporated completely. And instead of doing this entire swapping on the interior of Cauchy slices like this, you do the swapping only on a partial Cauchy slice, something like this. And at the point where you do the swapping, this is like the branch point of these replicable wormholes. And Okay, this is shortness of time. I won't perhaps explain the details, but this is really a Lorentzian picture of what a space-time, of what one of these replica wormholes looks like. Now, because you're doing this thing, because there's this sort of branch point here, where you're doing the swap, it comes with a certain cost of action. So these things are very non-perturbatively suppressed, and they sort of back react. So there's some cost, which is we can roughly think about as being proportional to the area of the black hole in Planck units, which means this is very, very suppressed for most purposes. But if you perform the swap test after the page time, we now know that these things should dominate. Okay, and that means that the prediction of semi-classical gravity, this is the last slide, the prediction of semi-classical gravity is that, sure, it looks like you get a mixed state, but any observer and any experiment they do will actually get a pure state. And in particular, these replica wormholes, they don't see the mixedness because they don't count this entanglement with baby universes. Perhaps I'll just leave that last slide up and invite questions and finish there. Thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot, Henry. We have some time, so we can take any questions. So feel free to unmute your mic and ask questions.
Okay,
Henry. Go ahead. Go ahead, Dom.
Yeah. I was just wondering, so if, let's see, when you do the gravitational path integral, it seems like from what I understood, what he says, like sort of every alpha state corresponds to a certain choice of CFT at the boundary. But when we do the path integral in the bulk, there's like one gravitational path integral, right? So, say I asked you, like, give me some path integral which calculates gravity in one of these particular alpha states. How would that look like?
So the important, let's see, okay, all the way back. So the important thing is that these alpha states, so we have a single theory of gravity here, and that's dual somehow to many possible theories of sort of boundary theories. Well, that seems to be the way. So these alphas are particular states of closed universes, particular states in HBU. But our definition of HBU was that it's created by asymptotically ADS boundaries or superpositions of those. So what that means is that at least one way to go in an alpha sector is I insert some extra boundaries that are hanging around, some complicated boundary condition that involves probably exponentially many boundaries, or really some superposition of different states of exponentially many boundaries, something that's probably very complicated. And then I do the calculation with those extra boundaries hanging around. If I insert some other boundary, it always has the option of going and joining into one of these other boundary conditions that I've inserted. There's some more explicit versions of this, for example, in JT gravity. There's a nice paper by Blumert, Mertens. There may be a third author, I've forgotten, my apologies, who talked about at least doing a partial version of this, so fixing some alpha parameters, if you like, by inserting some sort of D-brain, if you like, in the bulk. And there's a D-brain on which the space-time can end. And that's a D-brain on which space-time can end is essentially, you know, you can see that's very similar to inserting other boundaries.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah.
Just to follow up on that, you know, when we were in two dimensions with SYK, we were naturally thinking about averaging over boundary theories or couplings. Yeah. When I go to ADS5, do you have a notion of what I should be thinking there?
This is an excellent question. That is, perhaps one of the most pressing questions. So one possible thing to say is that, so at least everything I said at the end was talking about just using semi-classical gravity and sums over metrics and not worrying about brains and UV completion and so forth. And this one possibility is that if you only know that low energy stuff, you end up with this these sort of ensembles and alpha sectors and so forth. So, okay, you get unitary predictions, but you don't, doesn't tell you about sort of what the energy of the microstates are and so forth. But then if you to add in brains and strings and other UV bulk degrees of freedom, then these would somehow isolate some particular alpha state. And in particular, so they make the Hilbert space of the baby universe is one dimensional somehow. And like understanding how some theory of gravity, how string theory does that is sort of the probably the most pressing question. But so in some sense, it means that this set of diffeomorphism invariants is giving us the null states is acting in the most dramatic way possible. It's acting so dramatically that there's actually a single state of closed universes. So the prediction is that in the context of ADS5 cross S5, say, this is say the fact that there's a unique joule in that, A equals 4 Yang Mills is supposed to be the unique joule. That's predicting that there is only one state of cosmologies in type 2B string theory, or string theory, in fact. And so, yeah, this is a point of view, again, that's advocated in a recent paper of Vaffa and, again, apologies to his collaborator. But, they advocated this point of view.
Can I ask you when, at the bottom of your slide here about the number of independent states being bounded? So you seem to be saying that 1,000 people made a mistake. Do you have any insight into what that mistake was?
I think the lesson is that the topology changing processes that we usually think of as being exponentially small and so forth are more subtle than we'd realized, because they have to be conspiratorial. They have to It's an old observation that you can take a maximally mixed state, say, on a very large Hilbert space, and by adding exponentially small off-diagonal terms, you can actually reduce the rank to something very small, even to one. So a pure state can have components of a density matrix that looks exponentially close to being maximally mixed. And these topology changing processes are adding in those exponentially small corrections, but there's a conspiracy between them. And the fact that conspiracy exists seems to be guaranteed by having some quantum mechanical description of gravity, but precisely how it works out, again, is something that we'd love to understand better.
Okay, thanks. And that was a great talk. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Could I ask maybe a point about, you say this this kind of redundancy on these states, you think it's related to diffeomorphism invariance. I guess it's a little hard to think about what diff invariance means when you have topology change. So do you just view it as like an actual redundancy? Like the way you presented it is you just have null states. So I don't know, like in maybe like if you're constructing, for example, a rep of Virasoro, you can also get null states, and it's not necessarily coming about from a gauge symmetry as in the sense of a gauge group. So I wonder, do you know if there's anything like that where you have like a symmetry group, or it's just you view it as some, is there a way to possibly describe what that gauge something is?
I really want to think about it as coming from diffs. One way to think about this, let's see if there's a good picture that can illustrate this. is to imagine you were to try to, let's try to do this by really doing the bulk, rather than constructing it from amplitudes, to choose some gauge fixing condition that tells me where my slices live, and trying to sort of solve Wheeler-Weld equation in that more direct way. So I might start off by, maybe I impose that I have a Cauchy slice of minimal volume or whatever I want to impose that picks out this slice. But when I have topology change, so that might sort of fix all the continuous pieces of the diff symmetry, if you like. But when I have topology change, there might be several slices in the geometry that have the same, that would obey my gauge fixing condition. So it means there's some, I haven't managed to totally fix the gauge. So I've fixed all the perturbative diffeomorphisms, but there's some large gauge transformations that I'm yet to fix. And those are the things associated with topology change. And
sorry, do you mean large in the sense of not continuously connected to the identity, or just something else, like actual like Dane twists of toruses and things like that, or something else?
I had in mind things that weren't continuously connected to the identity, but I guess maybe they could be continuously. Well,
like maybe.
When there's topology change, then there's no diffeomorphism between spaces of different topologies. So. I'm not sure I had anything even that specific in mind.
Okay.
But at least I have in mind that you impose the sorts of gauge fixing additions that people do in conical cosmology and so forth to compute the fluctuations of in the microwave background, except you find that when there's topology change, it doesn't completely fix the gauge. It fixes the gauge for infinitesimal diffs, but there's some discrete choice, and these extra null states come from fixing that discrete choice. And I think theta vacua in QCD, for example, are a little bit like that.
Okay, thanks. Are there any final questions from the audience? Okay, so I think we've had a good amount of discussion. So feel free, let's thank Henry again for this nice talk. So.